From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Today is one of the darkest days in the history of the United States of America, and we will fight.
Everyone just needs to take a deep breath. The sky is not falling. This is not a ban, and I think words matter. This is a pause.
An intense week in Boston with the fallout from President Trump's executive order on immigration. We'll look at all that happened this week, plus the latest from Boston federal court on the legal case challenging the order. Also, we'll check in with Shira Springer in Houston as the clock ticks down to Super Bowl kickoff. And
the progress that we've seen has been so dramatic in so many cases that I think we can safely project ahead that we have turned the corner.
Our series This Moment in Cancer comes to a close with your calls. It's Radio Boston, first the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In Boston federal court today, Massachusetts civil liberties lawyers argued that President Donald Trump's executive order on immigration violates the United States Constitution and should be permanently overturned. The case comes at the end of a tumultuous week in Boston following the president's signing of the ban on Friday night, one that immediately barred visa holders from seven Muslim-majority countries. More than 100,000 visas have been revoked, that according to a government lawyer in a separate case heard today in a Virginia federal court. Well, joining us now from the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston is WBUR's Shannon Dooling. She's been covering the story very closely. Hi there, Shannon.
Hi, Meghna.
So there was a hearing today at the Moakley Courthouse. What was the mood like? What was the scene like in court?
It was a packed courtroom, to say the least. There was a waiting list circulating to get into the courtroom, both for media and for members of the public. This has obviously generated a lot of interest locally and nationally and internationally. We've been hearing all week about this decision, about whether or not this temporary restraining order will be extended beyond the Sunday deadline.
Mm. Now, what argument, then, did the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts that's arguing this case, what did they say? Why did they say they think the ban is unconstitutional? On what basis?
Well, basically, their argument is that this executive order focuses on a narrow group of people, those seven majority Muslim countries, and that by doing so, it's banning them from traveling effectively based on their religion. Matthew Siegel, who's from the ACLU of Massachusetts, one of the lead lawyers for the plaintiffs, also said that while the Immigration and Naturalization Act does grant the president broad power to deny entry into the country of certain people that, you know, in the interest of keeping the nation secure, what Siegel and the ACLU is arguing is that the president did so with what he's been calling malintent, that the context here, we have to consider, you know, the tweets from the president along the campaign trail and things like that to kind of get the full picture here, and that the president's intent was, in fact, to ban or suspend the entry of Muslims in particular. So hearing today, sorry about that. Let's hear a little bit about Matt Siegel.
What we've seen in the last week is people have been thrown into chaos. Their lives have been upended. I mean, what we're talking about is affecting people's lives every day. And what this case is about is about battling for those people's lives and really battling for the soul of the country.
So Siegel says that if the judge does not extend the temporary restraining order, we should expect to see chaos here in Boston and around the world.
Hmm. Okay, so that's the argument that the Massachusetts ACLU is making, looking to the Constitution there. What did the defense, the government, have to say?
I must say that the lawyers for the U.S. Justice Department did not appear to sort of have as robust of a preparation as the lawyers for the plaintiffs did. But they did argue that it is a necessary safety measure, this executive order, and that the president does indeed have the right to keep the country safe. And the lawyer for the government reiterated that there is no Muslim ban and that this executive order is faith neutral.
Hmm. Now, Shannon, just to underscore a point you made a little earlier, it seems one of the key issues here is just how much power is held by the president under the law. It seems as if the judge is being asked to decide if power in this case is defined by the Immigration and Naturalization Act, as you said, or the United States Constitution. So did the judge hearing this case give any hints in his questioning about where he might stand on that?
You know, he sort of did. Judge Gorton asked the attorneys for the plaintiffs repeatedly to show him where the executive order mentions a Muslim ban. Where does the executive order specifically mention majority Muslim countries? If you'll recall, it lists seven countries, but it does not refer to those as majority Muslim countries specifically in the executive order. Judge Gorton read from the executive order verbatim several times. He also read from the Immigration and Naturalization Act several times. He talked about the powers of the president inherent in the INA, and he pushed back hard on the lawyers for the plaintiffs when they tried to argue that, again, given the context of Trump's previous remarks, his previous tweets, his campaign promises, that, you know, it's imperative that the court realize that this is a religious ban. That's the lawyers for the plaintiffs are arguing. Now, Judge Gorton said the president's powers are indeed broad when it comes to immigration. But he also said to the lawyers for the plaintiffs, listen, you're asking me to extend this restraining order, assuming someone in the government may do something illegal, because, again, the lawyers for the plaintiffs were unable to point directly to anything in the executive order that mentioned specifically majority Muslim countries or a Muslim ban.
Interesting. Well, Shannon, we spoke with you earlier this week about a State Department memo that surfaced, just in the past couple of days, which authorized the revocation of those visas for visitors from those seven countries. What was said in court today about the status of those visas?
Right. The attorney for the government said that, yes, pursuant to that State Department memo that we've been reporting on, visas for people from those seven countries listed in the executive order have been revoked. What's interesting is that two of the plaintiffs listed in this case are, in fact, F-1 visa holders from Iran. Judge Gorton asked if their visas are revoked, and the government's attorney said, well, yes, pursuant to the State Department memo, and the government's, yes, they would be revoked. And the government's attorney also said that if those two plaintiffs were to travel abroad, if they were to leave the country, they would be barred from reentry. I should say those F-1 visas, those are student visas. Mm-hmm. A State Department spokesperson told us Wednesday, however, that the revocation of visas would not have an impact on the legal status of people already in the country, which, according to that statement from the spokesperson at the State Department, sounds like the plaintiffs would not have been impacted. But the federal government basically showing some mixed messages here.
Depending on which part of the government you're speaking to, it seems. Okay,
exactly.
So, Shannon, then, when can we expect a ruling from Judge Nathaniel Gorton, and what might happen next?
So the judge says he'll issue a decision before the expiration of the temporary restraining order, which is set to expire early Sunday morning. You'll recall that it was handed down by two judges on around 2 a.m. last Sunday morning. He says that, you know, he's taking everything into consideration, and he will promptly make a decision.
That's WBUR Shannon Dooling bringing us up to speed on the Massachusetts case against President Trump's executive order on immigration. Shannon, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, that hearing happened a little bit earlier today at the Moakley Federal Courthouse and over at Logan Airport just this afternoon. That sounds of cheering at Logan, where demonstrators and college officials gathered to welcome back some college students on a flight that landed just this afternoon from Germany. U.S. Representative James McGovern and Worcester Polytechnic Institute President Lori Leshin welcomed back Benham Partapur. He's a WPUI student originally from Iran.
We've been in very close touch with this student, as well as another postdoctoral fellow who at this point has made it back in the country. We've been working this round the clock since basically Saturday morning.
So it seems every second of the day this week, something has been happening. So to help us sort through it all, Tiziana Deering, professor of Boston College School at Boston College's School of Social Work and a member of WBUR's Community Advisory Board. She's joining us today for our Week in Review. Tiziana, great to see you.
Great to be
can
here.
Can you see I can barely catch up with myself? Also with us today is Charlie Chipio. He's a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute. Charlie, it's great to have you as well to help us wrap
good
our heads around
here.
This. Okay, so first of all, let me just start. Just give it your top-line reaction of the tsunami of events that have been happening here in Massachusetts around immigration. Charlie, go for it.
Well, it brings me back to my days of finishing in the bottom 10% of my law school class listening to all this. But it does not seem to add up, and it all just seems to continue the moves of an administration that is incredibly disorganized. But the more important issue is, you know, clearly based on even the public comments that Rudy Giuliani made, that you know, you can dress this up any way you want, but clearly this is seems to be banning people from returning to or coming into this country based on religion, and it's not much that's more against the spirit or the letter of the Constitution than that.
Okay, well, let's throw a little bit of tape in here. This is President Donald Trump himself talking about what the order means. This is on Saturday.
It's not a Muslim ban, but we're totally prepared. It's working out very nicely. You see it at the airports. You see it all over. It's working out very nicely. And we're going to have a very, very strict ban, and we're going to have extreme vetting, which we should have had in this country for many years.
And the president later tweeted, it doesn't matter what you call it, he thinks it's working well. Tiziana?
Well, yeah, and the wizard also kept saying, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right?
Yeah.
And it kind of feels like that. I've been desperately trying all week to kind of figure out, if this is what it's going to be like now, how do we get back to first principles to try to make sense of things and figure out how to react to things as they come tumbling down? Yeah. And as I listen across this, I feel like three things come out, and they're the questions of competence, constitutionality, and cruelty. And what we have here is this bizarre intersection of something that's questionable from a constitutional standpoint, incompetently executed, and cruel. And it does seem like we all ought to be able to get around those three, if yeah. nothing else, and yet we can't really even seem to get back to
okay,
those
principles. Okay, but let me ask you both.
Yeah.
We have had people call in on our show, sit at this very table, who very passionately say what's cruel is not doing something about immigration, strengthening the borders, tightening the restrictions, such that you're not making America as safe as possible.
So it already takes more than a year, the vetting process, to get into the country. This is very different from people swimming across the Rio Grande to get into this country. You know, I look at all this and it brings to mind those words of Thomas Friedman, the Times columnist, who says every time we give out a PhD in this country to a foreign student, we should staple an H-1B visa to it, because these are the people that we want to keep. And what we're doing is we're chasing them away. It's against our self-interest. Even if you, I totally agree with everything Tiziana just said, but even if you put that aside, it just does not make sense. It's just not in the interest of the American people.
Yeah, so let's totally stipulate that argument, that we do need to keep our borders safe, we need to protect ourselves from terrorism. We go back to the competence question. Is there any data or any precedent to suggest that this is the thing that is going to do that? And the answer is no. In fact, we all go all the way back to the seven countries named in the executive order do not happen to have originated any of the terrorists who have attacked us on American soil to this point. And
to this point, I mean, I think that's the thing that Donald Trump himself would say right there. Yes, they haven't so far, but he has to think into the future about what could happen
next.
Well,
apparently in the future, the countries where he has done or is doing business are not the ones that are going to attack us.
Yeah,
that
and
seems
this
to
isn't
be the rule
a
here.
Thinking into the future. This is a knee-jerk reaction to score political points with marginal impact on deep issues that require multi-party collaboration to develop good solutions. None of that's happening here.
Well, I want to play a little bit more about, again, the tumult of news and reaction and emotion and thoughts that people in Massachusetts have been feeling this week. On Twitter a while ago, just over the weekend, I saw a picture from the Copley Square rally that happened on Sunday, and there was a protester holding a sign that said, well, I guess we're doing this every weekend now. So on Sunday, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, in front of thousands who rallied at Copley, really pushed back hard against the president's executive order. Here she is.
Little girls who flee murderers are not a threat to the United States. Elderly grandparents in airports are not a threat to the United States. Students, teachers, people who work right here in Massachusetts are not a threat to the United States.
Mayor Marty Walsh also stepped up at the same protest, and here he is.
We'll protect you with a sacred document that this country was founded on, called the United States Constitution.
All right, so those are two Massachusetts politicians. But as I said, we've heard from people, just regular residents, who feel quite differently. Here's Blaine, Cambridge resident, who called into Radio Boston on Monday.
Everyone just needs to take a deep breath. The sky is not falling. This is not a ban, and I think words matter. This is a pause. So everyone that's kind of framing it as a Muslim ban or ban against certain immigrants, that's just not true. Sovereign nations have a right to protect their borders.
Tiziana and Charlie, react to that. I mean, I've heard a lot of people say exactly this. It's 90 days or it's 120 days for refugees. The sky is not falling, according to them.
Well, it's quite a precedent, though. You know, if they can, I think the question becomes, if he can do this, then what else can he do? I mean, I think the rubber is really going to hit the road here when we get to the point where we see if this administration abides by court orders or, you know, if we're quickly going to get into this, you know, United States versus Nixon kind of situation. I think that's really the issue. The issue here is that the issues and the concepts that are on the table here are central to what this country was founded on. And if we are going to go against those, then, you know, that is serious, even if it only lasts 90 days, which let's see what happens in 90 days. I'm not sure I'm convinced, but these are very major issues. There are boundaries outside of which you cannot go, according to the Constitution.
You know, I remember listening to that caller on Monday and having quite the conversation with him in my head in my car as he called in. And there were two things that I thought. One, tell that to a Syrian refugee. It's not a pause to Syrian refugees. And two, there is a difference between something being temporary and something being a wedge. And I can tell the difference between something that's temporary and something that's a wedge. And this is a wedge.
Yep.
So, Tiziana, I want to touch on another one of the three C's that you mentioned earlier, incompetence. Mm-hmm. Is that because there seemed to be mixed signals coming from members of President Trump's own administration this week on exactly how effectively or whether or not the executive order was effectively implemented? Because on Wednesday, Homeland Security Secretary General John Kelly spoke at a press briefing, kind of giving uncertain information about how much his staff was involved in the executive order.
From day one, finishing touches, I'd have to put it that way, were being put on the executive order. As I say, the high-level folks in the government, attorneys as well, were part of that. People on my staff were generally involved.
Generally involved is the phrase that keeps catching my ear there. Then on Tuesday...
People on my staff.
On my staff, and not even
him.
Yeah. Tuesday, Press Secretary Sean Spicer really pushed back against the idea that John Kelly wasn't adequately briefed on the executive order. Here's Sean Spicer.
Part of what we're trying to do is make sure that people actually understand what happened, what the process was, and what the order actually does. Because when we use words like travel ban, that misrepresents what it is. It's seven countries previously identified by the Obama administration where, frankly, we don't get the information that we need for people coming into this country.
Charlie, your thoughts? I mean, many people have pointed to these seven countries identified by the Obama administration. That actually had to do specifically with the visa waiver program,
right?
Not necessarily a full-blown ban on visas from those countries. But your thoughts on what's going on in the government?
Well, look, they just don't seem to know. There, you know, at one point they were saying that if you had a visa, you were going to be fine, and then they started revoking visas.
Then there was all that question about green card holders.
Yeah. So I mean, it seems to be a moving target here, and you just don't know from day to day what the rules are going to be. And that's just bad governance.
You know, Donald Trump from day one ran on a platform of being a chief executive, a successful, powerful, capable chief executive. And when a famous commentator from your own party says to call it amateur hour in the White House is to slander amateurs, you know that you have a problem with competence. This is the thing. Actually, it was David Brooks.
Ah.
This is the thing he's supposed to be good at, is competent chief executive management of a complex operation. And we did not see one indication of that. The only other conceivable possibility is he's doing this chaos on purpose, and that would be even more disturbing.
But let me ask you about that, because I think some people do wonder about that, that, you know, in a way, it's the classic disruption theory applied to government and applied to the functioning of the United States of America. You want big sweeping change, you disrupt it wholeheartedly. That's happening.
You usually have something that you put in place. And what we have right now is the disruption with zero replacement, just the disruption.
Yeah,
that's a moral question, if nothing else.
It's kind of like the FDR first 100 days. I mean, the idea is to just do so much stuff so fast that people can't react.
Well, I want to play a little bit of tape here from people who are at the receiving end of these executive orders, and those are the immigrants and visa holders who either are in Massachusetts right now or were trying to get back here. Here's some tape of the wife of Hamid Hosseini Bey. He's an Iranian man who was detained at Logan on Saturday after trying to get back to the United States after caring for his sick father. His wife spoke with WBZ's Jim Smith on Saturday.
It's just terrifying how my life has changed in 2 days, 2-3 days. Last week, everything was normal. I would pick up my daughter from preschool, you know. She was like everyone else. I was like everyone else. But now we are different.
And here's another piece from Mina Yakmozadeh. She's an Iranian PhD student at Northeastern. Just Wednesday, she told WBUR that she had chosen to live in the United States rather than in Europe because of America's history as being a nation of immigrants.
People from all over the world live together here, and I felt like this is the best place for immigrants. I felt like there is no limit here to progress. Until last week, I felt like that was the best choice, but now, I don't know.
It's, the whole nation has a story of immigration behind it, but in Massachusetts, there's, you know, we've got hundreds of years of it, and I acknowledge, of course, it came at a cost for Native people, but also the very soul of the state today, given the economy, given where we're going, relies on immigration. What does it make you think when you hear those reactions from folks?
Well, first, it just makes me want to apologize as a citizen. Honestly, the number of times that I've just wanted to apologize on behalf of my country, and I don't mean disrespect to those who agree with the intentions as expressed behind this executive order, but I do think that we are sending a set of messages of condemnation, lack of openness, lack of intellectual curiosity about what others can bring to the table, and a lack of understanding about solidarity and community that shows fundamental bad judgment about what we can do when we're united together.
Charlie?
I guess I have a personal reaction. It just makes me want to go back down to Ellis Island and, you know, sort of stand by the place where the names of my mom and her family who came to this country are written. You know, it's just mind-boggling to me. I'm really at a loss.
Yeah. I mean, full disclosure, both my parents immigrated to the United States, to Boston first. So I hear you. But I want to ask you both a question. We have spoken and heard from many people who voted for Donald Trump who say it's not that they're opposed to immigration. I mean, their own families have strong immigrant history and ties, but they're opposed to what they see as unfettered immigration, uncontrolled immigration, and they don't see why there can't be some kind of change, some kind of tightening, strengthening of vetting, and that they resent, you know, being painted with this broad brush in terms of the powerful and emotional reactions we've been seeing all week long. I mean, what would you say to them?
I think that's fair, and I think it's really important to distinguish our powerful and emotional reactions towards the behavior of an administration, which is a small group of people in power who are making choices, versus those who put that administration in place for broader purposes. Mm-hmm. And I think it is actually, as part of being in solidarity and community with each other, our responsibility to be able to distinguish between a handful of people who, in my mind, are abusing power and those whose intentions may have put those people into office. It's important.
I have two reactions to that, too. For those of us of a certain age who remember, you know, George Wallace would get up and say that he wasn't a racist, too, you know, but, the you know, his deeds said otherwise. And, you know, on NPR this morning, actually, they had somebody, they were interviewing somebody in Western Pennsylvania, and the woman's reaction was, well, how can these people think that they can come to this country and take jobs? Well, isn't the idea of this country is that everybody has an opportunity, and those who can do the best job, it's supposed to be a meritocracy. And I don't think that the country is well served by saying, well, no, we have to save these jobs for these people who may not be as good at them as other people are. I mean, you know, that kind of idea in a different sense is what has gotten Western Europe into a lot of trouble, you know.
You know, Admiral James Stavridis, he's the dean at the Fletcher School at Tufts University now, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. He had an op-ed in The Globe, which struck a concerned tone, to say the least. But there was a paragraph in it which really stayed with me, because he wrote about how he was talking about refugees in particular, how these are people who have more motivation, are greater risk takers, more ambition than the average folks, because it takes a huge amount of courage and daring and heart to, you know, hold your 5-year-old child's hand and walk 200 miles to the Syrian-Turkish border. And he said, that's the kind of person I want on my team.
Right.
And actually, I think that's something that is forgotten, that every person who makes the decision to up and leave their country, you know, presuming they do go through an appropriate vetting process, is showing us something about who they are that maybe we do want on Team America.
Absolutely. You know, my mom used to always tell the story about when they got to Ellis Island, the idea that she would just watch all these people just get turned away and just sent back for the most random reasons, you know? I mean, so on top of, you know, taking your child's hand and walking 200 miles, you do it with nothing in your pocket. You have no certainty when you get there. I mean, it does take a very special kind of person.
Yeah, if you looked up resilience in the dictionary, there would probably be the picture of somebody who'd made that kind of trek. And yet I saw Pew Research this week that something like 70% of Americans feel that to be a quote-unquote true American, you have to speak English.
Well, I want to play one last piece of tape here. We're not going to do our hubbubs this week. I'm just going to say this. Sorry,
too
everyone.
Much.
I'm not. Usually I'm in the mood for them, but we're not. There's one more piece of tape I want to play, because this is President Trump. This week he also weighed in on the fact that it's about African American history. Excuse me, it's been a long week for me. Forgive me. And he talked about Frederick Douglass, of course, one of the great figures of American history. He talked about Wednesday about Douglass at an event. Excuse me, I'm going to get the sentence out of my mouth.
You can't do it.
And to mark the beginning of Black History Month, here's the president.
I am very proud now that we have a museum in the National Mall where people can learn about Reverend King, so many other things. Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice.
Okay, the reason why I wanted to play that is because it was actually inadvertently, perhaps, apropos of all that's been going on with immigration this week, because in 1869, if I remember correctly, Frederick Douglass was in Boston, and he gave a fantastic speech. I've referenced this on the show before. In opposition to the Chinese Exclusion Act, when the United States was denying the opportunity for naturalization to Chinese laborers who had been brought here. It's a long speech, but there's one line where Frederick Douglass says that he believes the wings of the American eagle are broad enough to shelter all who come here. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, perhaps, maybe that's something that President Trump might be thinking about, one hopes, as we go into the weekend.
And
here,
he mentions Dr. King, and you know, one line that he used repeatedly that I think is so great and apropos is when he kept saying, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice."
Yeah, and you know, this is not our first waltz. We have done this as a country a number of times before, chosen this isolationist, exclusionary path. And if we look at history, those with the open stance have been on the right side of history every time.
Well, Tiziana Deering is a professor at Boston College's School of Social Work and a member of WBR's Community Advisory Board. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a restful weekend, if such a thing is possible. And Charlie Chibio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute, thank you as well, Charlie.
Thank you, Meghna.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I promise to be able to get sentences out of my mouth for the rest of the show. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. All right, let's switch gears entirely, because all week it's been the run-up to Super Bowl 51, or yes, once again, Super Bowl LI. But with just 48 hours to go until kickoff in Houston, let's touch base one more time with WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Hello, Shira.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so is it all politics all the time down there in Houston?
No, of course not. The NFL would have no such thing. You do not want to mix football and politics. At least the league doesn't. And they have had players and executives and coaches sidestepping the politics questions all week long.
So has it felt a little strange? I mean, it's almost as if Houston's like this blissful little bubble outside the tumult that is the rest of the United States.
It absolutely is a little bit of a Super Bowl bubble down here where you feel really disconnected from what's going on in the rest of the country. It's, you know, all about meeting former players and current players and, you know, listening to the latest that Brady says and the latest that Matt Ryan says. It's all football all the time. And if you're a football fan, it is like paradise down here. And it's not just for Patriots and Falcons fans. I have seen jerseys from every NFL team in the country. This is the big event for them, and Super Bowl Sunday is like a national holiday for them.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because you wrote for WBR's Cognoscenti page, Shira, that the apolitical nature, or trying to make the Super Bowl a totally apolitical event, is in marked contrast to how the NFL began its season, where Colin Kaepernick for the 49ers was at the middle of a cultural and cultural conversation or controversy when he started taking a knee during the national anthem, right?
Yeah, and not only that, he sort of inspired both other professional athletes and college athletes to take stands, to raise awareness about the issues that they care deeply about. And now here we are, a complete reversal, and you hear no talk of politics, and it seems that the players are not hesitant, but almost scared of saying anything or doing anything that would be considered politically controversial. They don't want to provide their team with a distraction or give their team a distraction as they head into the big game. And so they speak very, very cautiously.
So let me play a little bit of tape here, though. This is from Falcons wide receiver Mohamed Sanu responding to a question, I guess, that he got about the executive order on immigration.
It's a very, you know, tough situation. And I just pray that, you know, us as a, you know, country and a world just can be, you know, united.
So, Shira, have the players not been asked at all about it, or have they taken some questions about this?
Oh, no, they've been asked. Yeah. Brady was asked. Mohamed Sanu was asked. And what was interesting about the Sanu press conference when he was asked, that was the first time he was asked about it. And then he was asked three or four times again. And each time his response was, I really just want to stay focused on football. I really just want to stay focused on football. So the questions have been thrown out there. The responses have been weak, to say the least.
Interesting. So I'm going to stick with sports and politics here just for another second, even though you told me you were blissfully in the bubble there. In Houston, because at least one Patriots player has said that he won't go to the White House if the Pats win. That was Martellus Bennett. And I want to ask you about him in just a second. But this isn't entirely unprecedented, right? Because Tom Brady didn't go to the White House when Barack Obama invited the Pats in 2015, even though he had gone in previous years. Can you just remind us why Brady didn't go in 2015?
Yeah, he said it was because of family reasons. And let's be fair here. He had made trips to the White House for the team's other Super Bowl victories. But there was a theory floating out there that Brady wasn't happy about White House Press Secretary, then White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest, criticizing Brady's PR skills and how he handled Deflategate. So there may have been a little bit of tit for tat, and it may not have all been family reasons, but that's sort of the operating theory and never confirmed by Brady.
I see. But Martellus Bennett has said that he won't go if invited this year for political reasons. Isn't that right?
He has, and he said that on media night here at the beginning of the week, and he really took a stand. I'd say let's wait and see. After winning, some players may feel differently. Martellus may feel differently about it. And I think the players also have to ask themselves, is it better to not go or to make a statement by going and saying something or trying to get Trump's ear and educate that, you know, Trump about their perspective? And, you know, when I was thinking about boycott a White House visit or not, it brought to mind the 1936 Berlin Olympics. And bear with me here. You know, there was this big discussion about whether the U.S. should send a team or not. And imagine what would have happened if they hadn't sent a team and you didn't have Jesse Owens winning those four gold medals and making a tremendous, not only, you know, athletic statement, but a tremendous symbolic statement against the Nazi regime. So I think after the game, after the foot, you know, they focused on the game, And it's over, players may reconsider what's the most effective way to perhaps make a political statement with regard to the opportunity to visit the White House.
Well, Shira, once again, I am mindful that we haven't even actually talked about football, but I'm going to reserve that for Monday, right? So,
okay.
So let's let the game happen. Let's let the gentleman play, and we'll talk about what happens on Monday. Hopefully, we'll be discussing a Patriots victory, right, Shira?
I'm supposed to be objective in this, but it would be nice to be covering a winning team.
Shira Springer is WBUR Sports and Society reporter, joining us from Houston, where she's been covering the Super Bowl all week, and we'll be there through the weekend. Shira, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today is the final day of WBUR's special series, This Moment in Cancer. From targeted genetic drugs to immunotherapies, we've been exploring why Boston researchers are feeling a renewed optimism about new research and discoveries that are revolutionizing the way we treat the disease. We've also explored how that optimism is tempered by the stark challenges that cancer patients still face. Here are some of the voices you've heard.
The progress that we've seen has been so dramatic in so many cases that I think we can safely project ahead that we have turned the corner.
The last few years has been an explosion in scientific breakthroughs and technologies that we can now apply to cancer and a lot of other diseases. So there is no better time to do drug discovery than today.
The immunotherapy, you know, saved my life. There's no doubt about it.
Some of the medications we give, you'll read, you know, the adverse side effects or reasons that we would stop a certain study that a patient's on and it's death.
One of the things cancer patients get a lot of is, oh, you're so strong, you're so resilient, and you just want to be like, you have no idea.
At BMC, when they come to us, their cancer diagnosis is often not their biggest problem.
Immediately when she was diagnosed, I had to stop working. Nothing is a guarantee at this point. If it came to any finances, I will do whatever I have to do to make sure that she stays alive.
I wish science was a little bit more advanced. I mean, I know it's going to happen. It's just the clock is not perfect for me.
We learned so much this week, but we imagine that there are so many more questions out there. So we want to hear from you, and we want to hear your questions, your thoughts. Have you experienced this revolution in cancer research? What was it like? Are you excited by the progress and maybe simultaneously even worried about bigger disparities? Patients and family members, healthcare professionals, what is this moment in cancer like for you? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Well, we're going to hear from a physician who does some significant cancer research in just a moment. But first, let me bring in Carrie Goldberg, who's host of WBUR's Common Health blog. She has been reporting on this moment in cancer for us all week, and in fact, for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So, Carrie, you've been immersed in this. How would you sum it all up?
Well, Meghna, you know, I'm not usually a complainer, but I have to say that it is hard to wrap your arms around cancer as a topic and to try to simplify it enough that it fits into one story or even one series, as you could hear in that montage that we just listened to. It's just so complex and so variable, and it shoots off in so many different directions. And, you know, my one consolation is that I'm not alone in this. Like when former Vice President Biden was here recently talking about his cancer moonshot, he talked about cancer as probably the hardest topic he's ever tackled.
For the first time in my career, someone's given me an assignment in an area that I know less about than my staff. I'm not being facetious. This is a daunting, daunting area.
So, Carrie, I take your point, but I also note that you didn't actually answer my question. How would you sum up this moment in cancer?
Well, so what I would say is what prompted this series was this sort of impressionistic sense that the mood in the cancer field has shifted, even just in the last couple of 3 years, that even though 600,000 Americans a year are still dying from cancer, and we mustn't lose sight of that fact, and there's a long, long way to go, there's also this sense of optimism and of progress that the field hasn't had in a really long time and maybe ever. And certainly the Obama White House cancer moonshot is a reflection of that. And, you know, I think the expression of that change in mood that has most stuck in my mind from my reporting on this series was something I heard from Todd Golub. He's the scientific director of the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. And he said that for the first time, the problem of cancer is looking tractable.
One can see a roadmap for what's needed over the decade ahead. It's not infinitely complex. It's really complex and hard, and that's why we're not going to solve the problem tomorrow. But you can get your hands around it now.
So to me, to hear something like that from a really careful and I would say very reality-based researcher who does not hype things. In fact, you know, researchers are very careful not to hype things because they don't want to raise false hopes. But it's just very striking.
Mm. So Carrie, I've got a couple more questions for you. But before we get to those, I do want to bring in the voice of someone who's in this field right now. She's Dr. Monica Bertagnoli. She's chief of the Division of Surgical Oncology at the Dana-Farber Brigham and Women's Cancer Center, and also the incoming president for the American Society of Clinical Oncology. Dr. Bertagnoli, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. So reflect on what you heard Carrie just say, that there's optimism of a kind that she hasn't felt or sensed before in your community of researchers.
Oh, definitely. You know, so much has come out of the dedication to understanding the biology of cancer. So many new insights. And these new insights now have real therapies that are linked to them that are working very well in real patients. So the issue is not that, you know, there's nothing new and that there's nothing new that's working. Mm. The main issue now is how do we use these? How do we improve on them so that they work for everybody? And how do we use the tools we have for an individual patient sitting in front of us, which is the big mystery and level of complexity.
So let me ask you, I mean, just what is the difference in terms of how you practice as a physician between how you approach treating cancer patient now than what it was, I don't know, a decade ago?
We have more options. And we have more people on the team. You know, I think even a decade ago, we still recognized that there were many different ways to treat cancers and that patients needed individual therapy specific for them. But now there are so many more people joining that team, so many more experts. You know, we have the traditional role of the surgeon, the medical oncologist who administers chemotherapy, the radiation therapist. But now we also have molecular biologists. Mm. We have pathologists who are absolutely central to deciding what happens to a patient. It's just a whole big, right, broader team.
Well, we are at the tail end of WBUR's special series This Moment in Cancer, and we would love to take your thoughts or questions or stories about your cancer treatment or family members or even if you're a researcher, about how treating cancer is different than it has been before. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I want to take a quick call here. Kayla is calling from Brookline. You're on the air, Kayla.
Hi. I really appreciate what you've been talking about all week. I think it's very important. But I think something gets lost in the ongoing conversation about cancer. I'm a 33-year-old Hodgkin's lymphoma survivor. Recently, just within the last year, I'm cancer-free. But what I've noticed is that kind of survival is just the beginning for some, which is lucky. But the conversation about kind of what cancer survivors and their loved ones and family continue to deal with even after, you know, say you had treatment and treatment is successful, I guess is just something I wanted to inject into the conversation.
Kayla, first of all, let me say that we are so delighted to hear that you're cancer-free. Mm-hmm. Just congratulations on that. And thank you for your call and for your thoughts. Dr. Bertagnoli, reflect on that.
Oh, so wonderful to hear that things have gone so well so far for you. There are about 14 million cancer survivors in the United States right now. It is a whole very large, very special population that has unique needs, and we are just beginning now to understand how to address the needs of these patients. They have higher risk of cancer. They have more toxicities from their treatments. And some of these things are lifelong. So it's a very active area of research. It's a very active area of concern for many of the big professional organizations.
Right. So, Carrie, you had mentioned this earlier in the week, mm-hmm, about there also may be a change in terms of thinking that cancer may be able to become a disease that's more considered a one that gets managed, like a chronic disease, than how we consider it currently. What does that mean,
yes,
for patients?
Although these are actually two separate issues.
Right, because you're talking about cancer survivors earlier. But.
Right. So Kayla is actually a survivor, yeah, but then for people with advanced cancer that isn't actually curable, more and more people talk about the goal is to manage it like HIV, for example. Like you take combination therapy and you have an open ended prognosis for how long it could last. That's a really big goal in the field now, I think. Right.
Well, you're shaking your head,
goal,
sort of.
I'm shaking my head because the big goal is to cure people, you know, to make it go away and never come back and never hurt anyone again and have it not be part of that their reality. And unfortunately, that can be difficult, not impossible. And when it's not possible, then the job is to make life the best it can possibly be.
Mm.
And that's where the focus needs to be, certainly when cure is not an option.
Let's take another call here. Lucy is calling from the Back Bay. You're on the air, Lucy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to applaud your efforts. This series has been incredible, and I especially appreciate you addressing the financial crisis that cancer brings to families, because so often when you think about cancer, you think about research and the incredible care teams, especially in Boston, that we have in our beautiful facilities, and that's what people think about when they think of cancer. But there's a whole other side. There's a reality that these patients have to go home. And how do they maintain a home? How do they afford a home? How do they heat their home? How do they afford a car? And that is a harsh reality that a lot of patients are embarrassed to talk about or think it's just them, but it's having a direct effect on their chance to access care, to adhere to their treatment. And it's directly affecting their chance of beating cancer. And I just wanted to applaud your efforts for bringing that to light this week.
Lucy, thank you so much for your call, because I think this is an extraordinarily important point when we think about the totality of what treatment means for cancer today. Dr. Bertagnoli, I mean, how often does this become part of what you as a physician think about when you're working with patients?
There's no part of someone's life that cancer doesn't touch when they have that diagnosis. You know, their relationships, their family, their children, their work, their economic status, and what they think about every single day when they get up in the morning. We physicians have got to be aware of that and participate in that as part of helping patients with their cancer journey. And, you know, we're not that good at it.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Well, we had a conversation about this just yesterday, because there was someone, our guest asked the question, like, where does care and treatment really end when you're thinking about the whole patient, and how well equipped are hospitals to provide that entire universe of support?
I'll tell you where we get our best is it's other patients. You know, we are so lucky that we have patients and patient advocates who reach out to other people who have this same issue, who can really relate to the experience. They help us figure out what we can do better and organize programs for cancer patients through the treatment. And also, you know, it speaks to the survivorship question, too, because one of the other big things we see is when we do succeed, making that switch over into a life of a cancer survivor as opposed to a cancer patient is something that the patients themselves are really teaching us how to help with.
And Meghna, I would just throw in, we will be doing more cancer stories throughout the year. And one of the stories I'm dying to do is cancer and work and how difficult it is to keep working or have protection. I mean, basically, as I understand it, being treated for cancer is not considered a disability. You don't really have a protection against being laid off, for example, if your company is small and it can't afford to replace you. So there are all kinds of cancer and work questions we'd like to get at.
Yeah. In the last couple minutes that we have, I'd love to hear from both of you where you think this, you know, this fast pace of change is going to go to next. Because in the course of the series this week, we heard about, you know, exciting new immunotherapies, about targeted therapies, you know, that really look for specific genetic markers in individual tumor types. There was also a story about a computer at the Broad Institute that has DNA data from 10,000 patients and is going to track the progress of their cancer. So that can provide additional power in terms of doctors trying to figure out how to treat folks. I mean, where might we be headed next here?
So I hope very much we're headed into the community of the data revolution, and that we really can look at a patient in our clinic and say, because of our access to data, because of our access to sharing across the entire treatment and research community, I know what has happened to people in your circumstances. And I have a better idea now, because of that shared data experience, how we can help you best. Mm. We've been so siloed and so selfish, all of us, in our sharing of the experience. And our patients have been telling us for decades, we want you to do this. So we need to listen to them. I think that is probably the biggest thing that's going to transform our ability to care for people in the short term.
But for that, you need the patients to stand up and say, I want you to share my data with each other, right? And that's a piece of the cancer moonshot the vice president, former vice president, had been pushing as well. People just have to share. It's what the patients want.
Well, Dr. Monica Bertagnoli is chief of the Division of Surgical Oncology at the Dana-Farber Brigham and Women's Cancer Center. She's also the incoming president for the American Society of Clinical Oncology. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
And Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog and one of the brains behind the cancer series. Thank you so very much, Carrie.
You're welcome.
I have to say that coming up next on WBUR's All Things Considered, we'll hear about the latest on cancer prevention. And go to WBUR.org and listen to the entire cancer series if you missed any part of it. Again, that's at WBUR.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.